Now on view at SCAD Fesh, Manish Arora's life is beautiful. Renowned for dazzling designs in a rainbow of colors, Manish Arora has brought the talent and craftsmanship of India's rich sartorial history to the global forefront, earning international acclaim on runways across three continents. Designing in India since the 1990s, Arora's glittering garments celebrate extravagant expressions of self through varied materials, techniques, and silhouettes in a triumphant union of Western and Eastern aesthetics adapted to today's multicultural society with a touch of humor. Find out more at scadfash.org.
Support for WABE comes from 100 Miles, a nonprofit committed to preserving Georgia's 100-mile coast. Protecting this critical coastal ecosystem takes all of us. Watch the stories of the innovators and future leaders who help keep our coast flowing at OurGeorgiaCoast.org.
From WABE in Atlanta, I'm Lois Reitzes, and this is City Lights. Since the pandemic has limited us, for the most part, to indoor home entertainment, you may feel like you've watched every series or movie available for streaming. If that's the case, why not step back into the 20th century and rewatch or discover one of those films considered an undisputed masterpiece. And if you're among those who must consult Rotten Tomatoes before viewing anything, please note that Casablanca has a 99% tomato meter score. And Rotten Tomatoes describes the movie as Hollywood's quintessential statement on love and romance. Further, Casablanca, made in 1942, has only improved with age, boasting career-defining performances from Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman. Today, we'll do a deep dive into Casablanca. The film Casablanca actually began as another movie in the Warner Brothers studio roster, but quickly took on a life of its own. And it's a phenomenon which persists to this day. The book We'll Always Have Casablanca was written by Noah Eisenberg, the George Christian Centennial Professor and Chair of the Department of Radio, TV, Film at the University of Texas, Austin. Previously, he taught at the New School in New York City, where he was Professor of Culture and Media and the founding director of Screen Studies. Going back to the very beginning, Professor Eisenberg explains, Casablanca was inspired by a high school teacher's trip to Europe.
Murray Burnett was a 27-year-old high school English teacher here in New York City, and he was an aspiring playwright, a recent graduate of Cornell University. And in the summer of 1938, he and his wife, Frances, they traveled to Europe. Murray Burnett had inherited a bit of money from an uncle, and he'd always wanted to cross the Atlantic, so they did so. This is just months after the Nazi Anschluss, or annexation, of Austria, and that's, in fact, where they ended up. They arrived in Antwerp, and they were sent on to Vienna to help Francis's extended family there smuggle out precious belongings. Jews and other political undesirables at that point in time were forbidden from taking any, if they were lucky enough to secure exit visas and leave Nazi-engulfed Austria, they were forbidden from taking their valuables with them. And so they smuggled out jewelry, a long fur coat that Francis wore on the train on, I think, a rather warm day in the summer of 1938. And they ultimately made their way across the demarcation lines and into what was still then free France. To celebrate, they were in the south of France, is where they finally found themselves after taking a train to Paris and then onward to the south of France. They were just on the outskirts of Nice, and they wanted to go celebrate their achievement in smuggling out these valuables. And so they went to a nightclub on the bluffs overlooking the Mediterranean Sea, and it was a nightclub that was frequented by a diverse clientele, people of all different nationalities. A babble of foreign tongues were spoken, and on the piano was a black man from Chicago, a crooner who was singing a medley of jazz standards. And it was in that very setting, smoky nightclub, all those different foreign languages, people of all different political stripes and backgrounds, that Murray Burnett turned to his wife Frances and said, "This would make a heck of a setting for a play." Oh. And so he wrote a three-act stage play called Everybody Comes to Rick's with his writing partner, Joan Allison, just a summer later here in New York City.
Yeah, what was the background of that partnership and their method of collaboration?
Yeah, so Joan Allison was a good decade older than Murray Burnett. She was a divorcee with a few children and had much, much more experience in the theater world here in New York City. And so he really turned to her for advice, for counsel, and many of the ideas that went into that three-act stage play, Everybody Comes to Rick's, came from her. Now, the origin of the story, though, goes back to what I just told you, that fateful journey to Europe in the summer of 1938. Marie Burnett, though, would sit at the typewriter, and Joan Allison liked to pace, so she would pace and smoke. She was a chain smoker at the time, as many people were, and he would hunt and peck at the keys, and they would do this often after school. He was an English high school teacher, as I mentioned moments ago, and so he would come over to Joan Allison's place here in Midtown Manhattan, and they would work for hours on end. They had met at one of the beach clubs here in just on the south shore of Long Island, and they struck up a friendship. People often speculated whether there was more to it than that their partnership was. Maybe there was a romance, but I was in the many interviews that I conducted for this book, it was Murray Burnett's widow who assured me that there was, in fact, it was just merely a professional relationship, but a very productive one at that. And this three-act stage play that they wrote in the summer of 1940 was what then ultimately made its way to Burbank, California, and to the studio at Warner Brothers. And it was a woman named Irene Lee, who was then the head of the story department at Warner's, who had the good sense to snap this up. The three-act stage play arrived there just the day after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, and it was a very, very timely subject. And it was Irene Lee who convinced Hal B. Wallace, the great producer at Warner Brothers, who was beginning to do a number of signature Hal B. Wallace productions. He had done Now Voyager just a few months prior. She convinced Hal Wallace to take on the project, and so that's what they did. And they paid the princely sum of $20,000, which is the most money ever paid for an unproduced stage play at that time. It was double of what they'd pay for the rights to Dashiell Hammett's The Maltese Falcon just a year prior.
Yeah, and so it was never really a play. I mean, it was
no, exactly. They initially, you're absolutely correct. They had shopped it around. They had an agent on 42nd Street, and they'd hoped, as any self-respecting playwright at that period would do so, they hoped that they would have a run on Broadway. When there were no takers on Broadway, they figured, "What the hell? Let's give it a whirl in Hollywood," and that's what they did.
So you have this high school English teacher, still in his 20s. Taking a trip that turns out to be transformative. I mean, Vienna in 1938 clearly altered his worldview for life and informed this entire story. Would you talk about the refugee trail?
Sure. So while Murray and Frances were in Vienna in that fateful summer of 38, among the encounters that they had is with these languishing refugees, many of them waiting, quite a few of them waiting in vain to secure exit visas. to leave Nazi-engulfed Austria at that time. But the refugee trail at that point led, and this is, you know, it's quite fitting that, that Marie and Frances traveled on to Paris. The trail then generally led onward to Marseille, and from Marseille to Lisbon, to Portugal, and that was the main point of embarkation. That's when you get in the historical prologue to the film. So when their three-act stage play was transformed into Casablanca by the Epstein twins and Howard Koch, when you have that opening prologue, this is that sort of folksy March of Time narration that we hear, it points that to that very refugee trail and tells us that Lisbon, which is historically accurate, was the major point of embarkation. And in fact, a number of the refugees who played in the film followed that very, very path. If you think, for instance, of Marcel Dalliot, who is Emile the croupier at Rick's Café, he and his wife, this is Madeleine Lebeau, who was the last surviving cast member in the production. She was a 19-year-old who plays Yvonne, Rick's on-again, off-again paramour. We see her in the first reel of the film, and then she returns on the arm of a Nazi soldier later in the picture. They had traveled that very route. They were married at the time, and they left Paris just in the after the fall of France, made their way to Marseille, onward to Lisbon, and using forged visas, they boarded a Portuguese freighter bound for Mexico. And in Mexico, they managed to procure Canadian visas that would make it possible for them to cross the border into California.
Nearly all of the 70-plus actors in the film were immigrants, in fact. Why doesn't Casablanca address the persecution of Jews specifically?
That's an excellent question, and one that many people have asked when I've been traveling around and giving book talks. And it's one that today seems so hard for us to get our heads around, for us to understand. Why wouldn't you address the very target of the Nazi persecution? And of course, there were others who were targeted, but the principal target of Nazi persecution, and the answer is really quite simple. Between the jazz singer and Gentleman's Agreement, Crossfire maybe a year before, but basically a two-decade stretch, you almost never ever have Jews addressed on screen as Jews. And so in this particular film, again going back to the interviews that I conducted, there's a wonderful interview with Andre Aciman, who wrote, among other things, that the novel Call Me By Your Name that was recently adapted to the screen. But he's a great fan of the film. And we were talking, and he says, you know, Noah, the Jews, they're all over the screen, but nowhere in the picture. And so they're there, but we don't actually have them identified as such. And the reason for that was that studios were loath to rock the boat. They just didn't want to. And in addition to that, so that's one piece of the argument, and only one piece. The other piece is that many of the people, even involved in this production, the director, for instance, Michael Curtiz, Hungarian-born director, he had family that was unaccounted for at that point in time. Cuddles, so S.C. Sakal, another Hungarian-born refugee, the actor who plays Carl, the waiter, the jovial, jowly fellow. He had family that was stranded. Many, in the case of both Curtiz and S.C. Sakal, these people would perish in the camps. And so they were very, very concerned that by, you know, were they to address the so-called Jewish question and to identify these refugees by their religion or ethnicity, that could even jeopardize more people who were stranded in Europe. So there was a reluctance there as well.
Story, in the film, are you saying that the actors would then be interchangeable? Because it seems like more of a studio decision.
You're absolutely correct. It is a studio decision. The irony here, and you're correct, among the 70, 75 actors enlisted in the production, nearly all of them were European-born, many of them refugees from Nazi-engulfed Europe. And so the irony here is that they're playing refugees on, so they're refugees playing refugees on screen, and nearly all of them were at least nominally Jewish. There are, of course, exceptions. You can think, for instance, of Konrad Veidt, who plays Major Strasser, the great Nazi official, and he was married to a Jewish theater actor, a woman named Lili Prager, a Hungarian woman. And so on principle, he fled Nazi Germany. The Nazis would have been thrilled. He was such a distinguished, decorated actor during the Weimar years. They would have been thrilled to enlist him in their productions. But he left on principle. Same is true of Paul Henreid, who plays Victor Laszlo. But many of the other, almost all the other, I should say, European-born actors enlisted in the production were at least nominally Jewish, meaning that, well, perhaps they didn't practice, but that's why they ended up, you know, that's why they were targeted by Hitler, and that's why they had to flee Europe.
Well, if not specifically saying the word Jew on screen, Warner Brothers is to be admired. You write, the specter of war and the big moral decisions that came with it permeated everything from the source material of Casablanca to the very climate in which it emerged. In what way was Warner Brothers unusual regarding Nazism?
Well, Warner Brothers was really one of the first studios to actively participate in the anti-Nazi cause, so to speak, to such a degree that when Harry Warner in September of 1941 was brought in to testify before Congress, he was accused, and this was the word that was used, of being a premature anti-fascist. They had made pictures already from 38 onward that addressed the Nazi menace, at least allegorically, if not explicitly, for instance, in Confessions of a Nazi Spy from 1939. And so there was a very vocal nativist and in many, many respects anti-Semitic faction in Congress at that time that brought in Harry Warner and accused him of beating the drums of war. What Harry Warner, who was really the moral conscience of the studio, his brother Jack handled the finances, but Harry Warner said, we're not doing anything other than showing the world what's really happening across the globe. And this was recognized. It was recognized by critics, by actors. It was Groucho Marx who, in 1938, said that Warner Brothers was the only studio in town with any guts, because many of the other studios were really reluctant to engage in what then later, after Pearl Harbor, came to be known as, of course, the Allied war effort. But this is even before we were in the fight, so to speak.
If you are just joining us, this is City Lights. I'm Lois Reitzes. We're listening to my conversation with the film historian Noah Eisenberg about his book, We'll Always Have Casablanca. Noah, among the many things to be learned from reading your book is how collaborative the writing process is for movies. Many writers rewriting each other's work, often together, some responsible for just one line. Would you tell us about the Epstein brothers? What was their strength?
What they called champagne comedy is what they were really best known for. They were known for adapting stage plays to the screen, and they were known for giving it that kind of bubbly, effervescent wit. And so a lot of the lines, for instance, many of the lines that Claude Rains's character, Captain Renault, that he, these real zingers, those are really attributed to Julius and Philip Epstein, the boys as they were known on the lot.
This cafe is closed until further notice. Clear the room at once.
How can you close me up? On what ground?
I'm shocked to find that gambling is going on in here.
You're winning, sir.
Oh, thank you very much. Everybody out at once.
And they had a real anti-authoritarian streak, and they, a big, as I write in the book, you know, the butt of their jokes was mainly Jack Warner, and they stole stationery from Jack Warner. There's a very funny, many pranks that they did, but one of the funniest I find is they were both students at Penn State, and that's where they got involved in theater. They were both boxers as well, so they were kind of punchy guys from New York's Lower East Side. And they got a hold of Jack Warner's stationery, and a friend of theirs from Penn State, a Gentile fellow, was in New York trying to get work as an actor. And so they wrote to him, and I wish I could tell you the name. I'm just going to call him for now Patrick O'Connor. But so they write to their dear friend, and they say that, you know, we envision, on Jack Warner Stationery, mind you, we envision a wonderful career for you ahead of you, but henceforth you shall be known as Hyman Rabinowitz, is what they say. And, of course, there's a long tradition in Hollywood, and at Warner's there was no exception to that tradition, of changing names. So, and there were a number of, actually, of actors who were contract actors at the time who had gone through such name changes. Edward G. Robinson, for instance, John Garfield. And so this was one of the many pranks that they did. But they also were very engaged in the fight against Nazism. They left just after a month of being enlisted in the writing process. They took off for Washington, D.C. and lent their support to Frank Capra, who was then tapped to oversee the Why We Fight series, a documentary series that was to encourage more patriotic support for the war, and was initially shown to servicemen and women, and then to the general public. But they worked on the first in that series, a film called Prelude to War, and then they came back, and I think there was a real sense of sort of spirited engagement. So they added that as well. Howard Koch, though, was the one who was known for being a bit more politically minded in his writing. He would go on to write Mission to Moscow, a film that would get him into trouble during the HUAC years. But Howard Koch was also a very important writer in this, as you write, it's really a patchwork, and you have a number of writers involved. So there's Howard Koch, and there are the Epstein twins. Those are the three who won the Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay. You do have, however, also Casey Robinson, who'd written Now Voyager. I mentioned that before. That's the blustery melodrama starring Bette Davis and Paul Henreid. This was one of the first of Hal Wallace's signature productions at Warner Brothers. And Casey Robinson was known for his ability to write that kind of blustery melodrama. And so when they felt that they being now Hal Wallace and Mike Curtiz, when they felt that the romance was sagging a bit, they brought in Casey Robinson to help with, there's a 9-minute flashback in the film that's nowhere to be found in the 3-act stage play. And they added that to kind of prop up or get the romance up on its feet. And so you have Casey Robinson's hand there. But this went through a number of other hands as well.
Please talk about Bogart and the character of Rick.
Yeah, so Rick, it's if we go back to the collaboration between Murray Burnett and Joan Allison, Murray Burnett, you like to claim that it was a combination, sort of a composite character. This is the way that on some level he saw himself, or he wished he could, that he would be. And then also, I guess there was another model, a friend of his from college at Cornell, who also had maybe had a bit more swagger. And it was Joan Allison who said, no. She had been married, I think, not just once, but twice. And the men that to whom she'd been married were always these kinds of characters like a Rick Blaine. But Bogart, who ended up, and it was very, very early on in the production, that both Hal Wallace and Mike Curtiz wrote in one of the, you know, there are lots of studio memoranda that were circulated throughout the production. One of the earliest of these studio memoranda said, the screenplay is being written for Bogart, is what Hal Wallace's memorandum to Jack Warner said. Jack Warner had wanted to know whether maybe George Raft would be a good pick as Rick Blaine. Bogart, it turns out, was just perfect for it, even though Bogart had really worried whether or not he could pull it off as a romantic lead. If you think of him as Sam Spade in The Maltese Falcon just a year before, you think of all these gun-toting, tough guys, street toughs. He really hadn't ever been cast in the role of a romantic lead, and it was his agent, Sam Jaffe, who knew that Bogart, he could do this. Jack Warner, who asked, he said, who would ever want to kiss Humphrey Bogart, is what Jack Warner publicly asked. But Bogart managed to do this. He was worried about the height differential between him and Ingrid Bergman. Ingrid Bergman was 5'9". Bogart was officially, I think, 5'9". He's probably about 5'8 or so. In that flashback that I mentioned moments ago, Bogart's on 3 or 4 inch platform shoes when they're dancing cheek to cheek to Perfidia. So he was worried about that. He was worried about his inability to dance. these things didn't matter, it turns out, because as Bogart said late in life, he said he did nothing different in this movie than he'd done in the some 30, 40 movies he'd made prior. It's just that you had a 27-year-old Ingrid Bergman looking at him with that amorous gaze in her eyes, and poof, suddenly he was a romantic lead and also the highest paid actor in Hollywood when the film wrapped, yeah.
I was very surprised to read that Bergman said she kissed him but never got to know him. The actor would withdraw, and I guess he didn't socialize with the others.
No, no, at least not with her. And when Ingrid Bergman said that I kissed Humphrey Bogart, but I never knew Humphrey Bogart, she was telling the truth. She at that time, in order to get a better sense of who this man was, The Maltese Falcon was still in general release, and she would go and watch his performance as Sam Spade over and over again to understand who this man was. And so, yeah, there was as much as the on-screen chemistry seems to be there, and the romance is just fully blown and palpable and wrenching. Off-screen, there was nothing.
Let's talk more about Ingrid Bergman. What did she bring to Ilsa?
Well, we were talking about Lois Meredith, the American counterpart, the slightly more, as I was saying, libertine step sibling, if you like, or alter ego of Ilse Lund. But what Ilse Lund, or what Ingrid Bergman, to be more specific now, Ingrid Bergman brought to the character of Ilse Lund was this kind of European sophistication, that demure, restrained sexuality. I call it sex appeal without sex in the book, and I think that's exactly it. At least that was my best my best swat at it. But I think that what she brings, and this is something that she did already in one of her earliest and most famous Swedish productions, a film called Intermezzo, a film made by Gustav Molander, was the Swedish director, and there was an American remake of the film as well. But it was while it was still being shown in New York, Hal Wallace was instructed to go and see this film, which he did, and it was there that he got the great idea to cast Ingrid Bergman in this role of Ilse Lund. But in that film too, both in the original Swedish as well as the American remake, she plays another character who falls for an older man, and yet the romance, as torrid as it might be in the minds of the viewers, is not depicted in any way. And again, for the American remake, and this is true for Casablanca as well, you have the Hays Code that's prohibiting any explicit depiction of sex. So that is I think in many ways working in tandem with what Ingrid Bergman brought to this particular role, in that she could suggest, and this was all about suggestion. I mean, this is what screwball comedy was about as well, all that innuendo and the suggestion. Don't show, you just suggest. And this is true in Casablanca as well. She is there's a kind of evocative eroticism, a suggestive eroticism, but it's not explicitly depicted on screen.
And so what was the role of Paris?
Well, the film historian Thomas Doherty, who teaches up at Brandeis University in Boston, He argued and he's written a lot on censorship, and in particular on Joseph Ignatius Breen, who was the head of the Production Code Administration. He says that the Paris can be seen as a code word for sex. So we'll always have Paris, we'll always have sex, basically describing what they had during that torrid affair in the summer just before the Nazis marched into Paris. And if you look at her relationship to Rick, in other words, to Humphrey Bogart's character, versus her relationship to Laszlo, the character played by Paul Henreid, it's so much more erotic, the relationship, the kissing, the passionate embraces and so forth between Rick and Ilse, versus just the little peck on the cheek from Laszlo. And I was giving a book talk in Mainline Philadelphia once, and a woman stands up afterwards. She says, "I'm a practicing psychoanalyst," she says. And she says, "You know what?" She says, "Victor Laszlo, Victor is daddy. That is who he is in this film." Oh. And it's Rick. Rick is the lover. And I think that there's something to that. If you look at the way that she During the famous scene of the Marseillaise, when Paul Henry, as Victor Laszlo, marches down there and tells the band to play the Marseillaise, there are reaction shots that we see, filmed by Arthur Edison, wonderful cinematographer, and we see in those reaction shots, some of them really quite tight close-ups, this admiration, but the admiration that you would show towards a father or a parent, it's not the same as when we see, for instance, when she comes back and visits Rick late night to see if she can get those letters of transit, those precious letters of transit from him, and the romance is rekindled. There we see them locked in passionate embrace and a long kiss, especially for that time period, a relatively long kiss. That's very different from her relationship to Laszlo.
Film historian Noah Eisenberg, talking about his book, Will Always Have Casablanca. More of this conversation is ahead on City Lights from WABE Atlanta.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Support for WABE's local coverage on maternal health and mortality comes from Georgia Health Initiative, whose mission is to inspire and promote collective action that advances health equity for all Georgians. Learn more at georgiahealthinitiative.org.
This is City Lights on WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thank you for listening. We'll return to my interview with the film historian Noah Eisenberg about his book, We'll Always Have Casablanca. The movie was released in 1942, and I asked Noah Eisenberg about the impact of the film on the Allied war effort.
Well, from the days and certainly the weeks and months after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, all feature films made in Hollywood were expected, and this is the other censorship body. So we have the Production Code Administration, the Hays Code, as it's often called. It's dealing with sex, adultery, no crime should go unpunished, and so forth. And then we have what's called the Office of War Information. And the Office of War Information is established just after the Americans finally enter into the fight. And so they're also vetting the screenplays and making sure that on some level they support the Allied war effort. And this is a film that does precisely that. People have argued about that famous final scene. But when Ilse goes off with Laszlo, boards that plane, bound for Lisbon, which incidentally is in the three-act stage play Everybody Comes to Rick. So this wasn't written just for the screenplay for the film. But when she does so, it kills two birds with one stone. It prevents them from running into hot water regarding the Production Code Administration, regarding the self-censorship body, the Hays Code, because were she to stay with Rick, it would be tantamount to condoning adultery. So, boom, that's taken care of. The other thing that it does is by boarding that plane with Laszlo, she supports his very important work as the great leader of an underground movement, his anti-Nazi efforts. So, again, it also then, it fulfills the needs of the Office of War Information and that support for the Allied war effort.
You wrote about a screening that took place at the White House with FDR. Is it fair to suggest that Casablanca may have influenced American foreign policy?
It's an excellent question, and people have speculated, and I would give a cautious yes as my response. I mean, I think the very fact that FDR chose to screen private screening at the White House, this was on New Year's Eve, 42 into 43, I think that this was shortly before the Casablanca conference. I think that this was something that Roosevelt saw as jibing with American foreign policy as he conceived it. In the film, you have in the character of Rick Blaine, in the character arc of Rick Blaine, you have, you know, those professions of neutrality, the isolationism that America had up until its entry into the war, basically espoused. And so the, you know, I stick my neck out for nobody, a line that Rick Blaine, that Humphrey Bogart says more than once, that too was in keeping with American policy up until Pearl Harbor. And so by screening the film on New Year's Eve and the private screening at the White House, I do think that Roosevelt was sending a message, and he would soon be traveling onward to that North African outpost, to Casablanca, to meet with Churchill. And also at that meeting was Charles de Gaulle, who was the leader of the Free French and been in exile. But I think that, yes, it wasn't just a little Hollywood distraction in choosing Casablanca for that private screening.
Hmm. Please talk about the role of Sam.
Yeah. So Arthur Dooley Wilson was born in Texas. He was a drummer, not a piano player. And in fact, it's off-screen is one of his bandmates. He played the band called the Red Devils. And one of his bandmates, Elliot Carpenter, is playing off-screen. And so what Dooley Wilson is doing in the film is really playing air piano. Dooley Wilson was the only cast member who had actually traveled to Casablanca. And he, with his band, the Red Devils, they were playing a number of performances across Europe, mainly in France, a number of performances in Paris. And they then traveled onward in the 20s, I think it was, or it could have been even into the early 30s, to Casablanca. Dooley Wilson had played a number of minor roles, and this was, for him, a major breakout performance. And it was a performance that today, especially, you know, there's that scene, and this is one of those cringeworthy lines that people today in 2018, it's just hard for it to pass on by without stopping and raising your brow. And this is when Ilse Lund, when Ingrid Bergman asks about the boy. But apart from that cringeworthy line in the film, the performance by Dooley Wilson is a very dignified performance. It is a three-dimensional character, as was said in the review in the Amsterdam News, an African-American newspaper here in New York City. It says he's not playing a domestic, not a shoeshine boy, not a Pullman porter. He is a full-blown character.
Boss.
Yeah?
Boss, ain't you going to bed?
Not right now.
Ain't you planning on going to bed in the near future?
No.
You ever going to bed?
No.
Well, I ain't sleepy either.
He is a confidant and friend of Rick. There's the scene in the 9-minute flashback to Paris for that summer in Paris, when not only is he drinking with his good buddy Rick, but also of course with Ilse, and they raise their glass to one another. To this day, I do not know whether it was when it was shown in the Jim Crow South, whether they excised that particular scene. But that was, because it's Paris and not America, perhaps they allowed it. But you have the scene in which Ilse Lund and Dooley, so when Ingrid Bergman and Dooley Wilson raised the glass of champagne to one another, which is really quite radical, and that review in the Amsterdam News that I managed to dig up in researching for the book, it's you know, for audiences today, they may look at it and think, oh no, this is just some kind of caricatured performance that Dooley Wilson brings to Sam, but at that time it was really a cause for celebration in the African American community. Dooley Wilson was one of the oldest cast members in the film, and he was one of the cast members who died soon after the film's debut, within just a few years. But he'd played roles in A Cabin in the Sky and had other all-black cast, but he never managed to land another role like Sam.
Whose idea was As Time Goes By?
So that was Murray Burnett's all-time favorite song. It was the 1932 recording by Rudy Valley that he heard over and over again while a college student in Cornell University. The story goes that apparently he listened to it so frequently that he wore down the grooves in the record, and I guess he also drove his fraternity brothers to distraction. But that was his favorite. And so from Everybody Comes to Rick's, from the unproduced three-act stage play that he wrote with Joan Allison onward, it is part of the story. Now, Viennese-born composer Max Steiner did not want to include it. He wanted to compose his own theme for the film. Ingrid Bergman had already been cast as Maria in For Whom the Bell Tolls, and she cut off all of her hair, so the chance of doing retakes and incorporating Max Steiner's own theme was suddenly moot. And so he had to make do with it, and he works it in beautifully, just as he works in, you know, you can hear bars of the Marseillaise, and you can hear other sort of motifs that lace the score composed by Max Steiner.
Well, we certainly can say that the song has had an afterlife.
Yes, I mean, next to Over the Rainbow, I think this is perhaps the most cherished Hollywood theme song ever.
Play it once, Sam, for all time's sake.
I don't know what you mean, Miss Elsa.
Play it, Sam. Play as time goes by.
Oh, I can't remember it, Miss Elsa. I'm a little rusty on it.
I'll hum it for you. Sing it, Sam.
You must remember this. A kiss is just a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by.
After the war, how was Casablanca viewed in Germany and Austria?
Well, that's an excellent question, and there's a story that goes with it. So, what they did in West Germany, so the Federal Republic of Germany, it wasn't shown in East Germany, but in the Federal Republic of Germany as well as in Austria, is they lopped off 27 minutes of the film and did a highly censored and truncated version of the film to cut out all references to Nazism. Victor Laszlo is a Norwegian scientist, not the great leader of an underground movement. And this was during the Adenauer period in the Federal Republic of Germany. So this is when the United States really, really wanted to prop up West Germany against the Soviet satellite republics and puppet regimes like the German Democratic Republic, or East Germany as it was known.
So this is in the 1950s, early 50s.
Exactly. And this played until the late 70s. That was the version. It was dubbed, 27 minutes cut off, and this is what you would go and see. So it didn't have the kind of cult following that it had, say, in France or in Italy, and then a bit later in Sweden and so forth. No, in Portugal, I should say, as well, where it had a very ardent following. It took until the late 70s when art house cinemas, repertory theaters, would show the film in the English original, with, in some cases with German subtitles, in some cases without, but where audiences finally discovered the real Casablanca, and then you got an incredible response. And it is also to this day a beloved film in Germany, the unified Germany now, and Austria.
It is just absurd to think about erasing all references to Nazism. That wasn't even denazification. That was just Cold War, Red Scare politics.
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, this isn't just redacting a few lines.
No,
they really. I mean, you almost cut off the entire soul of the picture with those 27 minutes. And so, it was blasphemous, we might say.
How does Casablanca bridge generations? You include a very touching story about your father-in-law and the sociologist Todd Gitlin's remarks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a favorite picture, actually, for both of them. My father-in-law was born in what today is the Czech Republic, and he adored this movie. And you would think, and he'd fought with the partisans against the Nazis, he and his father, and survived the war in doing so. You would think that, Victor Laszlo would be, you know, he'd be with Team Laszlo, so to speak, mm-hmm. but he adored Humphrey Bogart. He was also a man of a somewhat diminutive man of about 5 feet, inches tall, and he always wore his trench coat. And I think that Humphrey Bogart, for him, was that great American icon. And when leaving after the war, finally fleeing Czechoslovakia, making his way to Canada first, to Montreal, and then onward to the U.S., I think that Humphrey Bogart was just that role model, that idol. Now, with Todd Gitlin was one of the great leaders of the Students for Democratic Society, while he was an undergraduate at Harvard, and. Harvard was the place where the film really began its storied revival at the Brattle Theater in Cambridge, when the owners of that wonderful movie house decided soon after Bogart passed away to do a Humphrey Bogart series, the centerpiece of which was Casablanca. And students would flock to these, and they would show always, this is an important piece of the story, is that they would show it during reading and exam period. And so you had all this pent-up energy in students, you know, from studying all day. They would go in the evening, and some would wear, you know, trench coats and snap-brim hats. And it was almost, it anticipates, in a way, the kind of cult response to the Rocky Horror Picture Show, but without the umbrellas and the rice. And so Todd Gitlin went to see this film with the same sort of monastic devotion as many students at Harvard and Radcliffe did in the late 50s and into the 60s. But for him, as a leader of SDS, he really saw the film. It spoke to him the kind of the political, the anti, in his case, like it was, you know, it was anti-fascist. And you know, this is in the early days of our involvement in Southeast Asia, and also in the free speech movement. So there was a kind of anti-authoritarian bent to it, if you will, or anti-tyrannical bent, and the way that it was reinterpreted by Todd Gitlin and company. The other thing that he said to me is he grew up here in Brooklyn, and it was a favorite of his parents, and it formed a certain bond for him with his parents, and it was a means of understanding them as well. And so, but he said, for instance, you know, he was a part of a relatively large group of students, politically engaged students, who came from New York City and were at Harvard in the late 50s, early 60s. And he said that when certain lines were uttered in the film, for instance, when Rick Blaine recommends to Strasser, when he says, well, how would you feel, there's a line that actually doesn't come from Strasser, but it comes from one of the bit players there, how would you feel if we marched into your, you know, New York City? And he says, well, there's certain parts of New York I wouldn't recommend you marching into. And he said they would sit up in the balcony and they would just scream their heads off because they, you know, that was part of the sort of the street tough, and that sort of gritty New York City, you know, scrappy sensibility and attitude that they felt that they too shared with Rick Blaine, you know, with Humphrey Bogart's Rick Blaine. So it was definitely a very popular movie for students in the 60s. And because it was the film that enjoyed more revival screenings than any other Hollywood film, people had an opportunity to see it, and this has a kind of a corollary as well in the age of television, in that it has enjoyed more airings on broadcast TV, and then now, of course, in the age of Turner, TCM, which may as well be called the Casablanca Channel because it seems to be on all the time.
You write that you taught your first Casablanca class 6 years ago. How did your students react?
You would think that the sort of the, and I teach at the New School in the Village, and you would think that these somewhat cynical hipster kind of students wouldn't have it in them to respond with the same sort of passion, and with the same sort of enthusiasm that maybe a generation or two students of a generation or two before them did. And I was completely mistaken. And mm-hmm. watching the movie, it was a seminar on Casablanca. It was on the films that kind of came before Casablanca, that brought about Casablanca, so to speak, and then the many iterations after it. But when watching the film and watching it with them, we watched it twice, seeing them respond, for instance, you know, I can't watch, and I've seen, I'm deep in the triple digits, but I can't watch the Marseillaise scene without getting a little bit misty in the eyes, and seeing them kind of tear up as well, and seeing them respond to the humor of Claude Rains's Captain Renault. And then in a very, very lively discussion after each of those two screenings, getting their take.
I was very surprised to read that one of the iconic lines in all of cinema was actually Humphrey Bogart's own.
No. He's looking at you, kid.
That's his own improv. There was not much improvisation done. They hewed really quite closely to the script prepared by the Epstein twins and Howard Koch, among others. But that was a line that you know, Bogart was purportedly fond of saying, and they used it. Of all the gin joints in all the towns, apparently that also came from Bogey.
Oh.
It's hard to parse what is truth, what is legend at this point in time. But here's looking at you, kid, for sure. There's enough corroboration. There are enough people who said that was just a favorite of Bogey's.
Tell us why you end the book with a reference to Senator Elizabeth Warren.
I did so not so much to endorse her as a politician, which I'm enormously sympathetic to the work that Elizabeth Warren has done over the years. So it wasn't so much to take a partisan position, but I love the way that she described it, and the way that she described it as well at this moment in time when we're dealing, you know, the film has a new register. It's a new, you know, it's always, I think, a resonant picture, but I think now it resonates in a kind of new context, and that is this context of the refugee crisis that we're facing once more. And so the way that she spoke about that, and this is a very 21st century source for the lines that I drawn. It was on her Facebook page, but I found that it was an appropriate way to end the book, a book that I had completed during this kind of tumultuous political climate in which we currently find ourselves today. And I loved the line that I quote as the very, very last line of the book. She says, "Each time I watch it, Casablanca gives me hope."
Noah Eisenberg is a noted professor of film at the University of Texas, Austin. His book is We'll Always Have Casablanca, The Life, Legend, and Afterlife of Hollywood's Most Beloved Movie. You've been listening to City Lights, our daily celebration of Atlanta arts and culture. Our producers are Summer Evans and Ryan McFadden. Kevin Rinker is our engineer, and I'm Lois Reitzes. I'd love it if you'd follow me on Twitter at LoisReitzes. Thanks for listening to 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Have you donated to WABE yet? I know you've heard us talking about why it's important, but it doesn't have to be this big decision. You can give at whatever amount fits your budget. It can be a spur-of-the-moment thing. You already get so much out of public radio, so just go for it. Visit wabe.org/donate and become a member right now. And thank you.